Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
And now here is your guest host, Mr. Steve Armiscow.
Hey, Cody, thank you. And the Mr. part, well, that doesn't happen often, especially, you know, before 9 o'clock in the morning. I don't get much on the Mr. I'm just honored that Tom allows me to grab this microphone and be the guest host of Voices of Montana. Welcome, everybody. Great to have you here. I can say we have a very intriguing conversation today. I am not an expert on it, but we've brought some experts to this conversation today that I think will help. It's intriguing because you've got two very large railroads that want to merge. Now, what the heck does that mean for Montana? You got the Union Pacific and the Norfolk Southern Railroad. I think UP does a little bit of work on the western side of our state. But other than that, why should we be concerned about this? Well, we've got experts here today to talk to us, and I'm excited to introduce to the Voices of Montana audience Dr. Hal Singer, or Hal, can I call you Professor Singer, or just Hal? What are your students? But Hal is from the director.
Hal's
the director of the Utah Project, and if I'm correct, a professor of economics at the University of Utah. Hal, welcome to Voices of Montana.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you for carving out some time. You're going to be our resident expert on the economic side of this proposed merger. We also have Lockie Edwards. Lockie, thank you for joining us. Lockie's a third-generation wheat farmer, farming just a little bit northwest of Big Sandy. Lockie, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
Gentlemen, let's start by giving our audience a little bit more depth on who you are and how you kind of approach this issue. Hal, first, I'm very intrigued. Tell us just a little bit about the Utah Project. What's the purpose behind that? So that our listeners kind of understand where your context, where you're coming from.
Sure. The Utah Project is an academic center at the University of Utah. It straddles the law school and the economics department. And we have been putting on events since I've been the head of the center. We've featured heads of Department of Justice Antitrust, the head of the FTC, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Mm-hmm. And we gather a bunch of folks, students, folks from the Bar Association, Utah Bar Association, come and have discussions. And we also put out a magazine called The Sling.
And so why the study on these corporate mergers? Why, and then antitrust and a little consumer protection is in the mix. It's part of your charge as a center, correct?
That's correct. Why study antitrust? I think I'm going to exploit, the whole Jimmy Kimmel affair, if you allow me, teaching moment here. Well,
right.
A good teaching moment, right?
All right.
I do think it provides some insight on the problem of monopolies. So, we've allowed a handful of firms to scoop up all the local television stations across the country. And so when you have a president with autocratic tendencies, I'm trying to be gentle, wants to, crack down on dissenting voices, it becomes much easier to silence his critics. Imagine trying to silence, hundreds of stations, whereas now you just need to get four and you get the whole slice of America. So concentration may not cause censorship, but it certainly makes us more susceptible to censorship. And I think this is a nice teaching moment of just one of the political costs of allowing industries to consolidate.
Okay. All right. We're going to talk about President Trump in the context of this proposed rail merger in just a minute. But Lockie, I want to get your voice into this conversation. First, I'm going to ask you, how's harvest time in Big Sandy area? How you doing?
I'll tell you what, harvest was baton death march. It was the longest harvest in my career, which is pretty long, since 1975 was the only harvest that was longer than this
one.
And it started raining. We had about half the crop in on our farm, and most people didn't have much in. And then it got, rained pretty good there in July, And then after that, it was what my brother calls nuisance rains. It just made it too wet to cut, but didn't really help. We're not against rain, of course.
Just the timing has to be absolutely perfect.
Timing was off all year on this crop, but that's okay. We'll prevail. The biggest problem is we've got some quality problems in the winter wheat, which is causing some of it to be trucked to Alberta to be fed to cattle, which is humiliating for us. So
now, Lockie, I want to give our listeners a little bit more of your background and why you're in this conversation about railroad mergers. And from the little bit of information you shared with me, I mean, you've served at the state level and national level for the National Association of Wheat Growers, and then currently you're on the Montana Grains Foundation, but you're also a co-founding member of the Ag Rail Business Council. You created that in 2008. What's the Ag Rail Business Council?
Well, so this is a long story, but I'll try to make it short, Steve.
Okay.
For a few decades, starting in the late 70s, we railed against the railroad, I'll use that term, and had our pitchforks out, and Montana spent millions suing at the STB for rate relief, and it was all about freight rates, and this went on forever, and we ultimately lost, and it was very discouraging. As I retired from the officer chairs at Montana Grain Growers, it was the one thing that I thought that we hadn't really made any progress on, and there was a little attitude shift. Railroads hate political turmoil. They like predictable stuff, and they like predictable regulation, and they like a quiet environment to do their thing. And there was a little shift at Fort Worth. As you know, Montana is largely a BNSF served state.
I've been at the Fort Worth headquarters for BNSF.
Oh, yeah, it's quite the facility.
It is.
They reached out. They had a kind of unique vice president of ag at the time, and he was, I think he was sent on a mission to solve the political turmoil in Montana, because that was their big hot spot politically. And that was Matt Rose. He was the CEO at the time, and he sent their VP to see if something could be done instead of throwing more gas on the fire, as they had been doing. So, anyway, we sat down, and
out of that came the council. Is that where that
out of that came a Montana council? We didn't call it a council, but a Montana effort to take a different tack, and that was more of an abundance mentality, and trying to understand. All the information at the time really lay within the railroad, and nobody shared that. The grain trade knew a lot of things, but grain traders won't tell you anything, or they'll lose their job. They're a very closed-mouthed bunch. And so anyway, we had some success, a lot of success, actually, in Montana. And then we had the idea, you know, these railroads are circulatory systems. What happens in far-flung places affect, you know, what happens in Montana.
Right.
So we had this idea in 2008, let's go system-wide with this. And so we put together a council made up of leadership from the national commodity organizations. That'd be soy and wheat and corn.
Excellent.
Are the big ones, and executives from Fort Worth at BNSF Railway, and we've met we meet twice a year, and we have ever since 2008.
So you have a rich experience in trying to make the ag industry, that partnership with rail, work effectively for both parties, and which has some context to this whole merger discussion.
Exactly.
So let me, I want Hal to jump in and for our audience explain how, what, talk to us about the merger. Tell us exactly, you got Union Pacific, what are they proposing? What is this merger look like?
Well, the merger, takes place. I think the context is important, right? I think the viewers or your listeners would probably understand it's just a merger of two railroads. But, you know, it's not just any other industry. Just like, you know, I mentioned the local TV station is highly consolidated now. It is happening throughout our economy, but also happened in the railroad. So I've got a stat for you. I think the number of Class 1 freight railroads just since 1980 has fell from 39 to 7. So that's a tremendous amount of consolidation. And then just since 2000, we've seen the industry kind of rolled up by now just four major railways that collectively control about 90% of the total domestic rail operating revenue. So again, I go back to this problem of concentration. It can not only lead to the exercise of economic power, and maybe we'll get into how that power would manifest itself here, but also political power in ways that distort the proper functioning of a democracy.
So Union Pacific is the big player. I think they're the most, if I'm correct me, please, they're the most profitable railroad in the country. And then you have North Fork Southern. And I don't know what their bottom line looks like financially, but they had some trouble in 2023 with a derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. And I don't know how they've responded from that. Is this merger motivated by, I want to use the term cleaning up, that mess? I don't mean to, because I know the people in Ohio are still kind of wrestling with what their lives look like. But is that part of the mix here? Is that, hey, you have a struggling railroad, let the big one take it over? Is that the motivation? What are they trying to get at with what their CEO says, what Union Pacific CEO says? We're going to have the first coast-to-coast rail system. Explain exactly what they're wanting to accomplish, what that merger would look like. You're putting two together. Yeah. Is one struggling? Is one doing well?
Well, you're getting to this key question of why. What's the motivation? And so, you know, there could be pro-competitive reasons. There could be anti-competitive reasons. So let me start with the pro. You know, so a defender of consolidation might say that mergers would allow them to achieve some kind of wonderful efficiency, like a cost savings. And those cost savings will ultimately be shared with shippers in the form of lower rates. And you might be smiling right now if that sounds silly, but there is some academic support. At least I could find one paper. There's a paper by a fellow named Yen, 2024, that claims that mergers have led to the elimination of interchange costs between rail companies and allowed these companies to achieve some economies of scope from operating a larger network. So that's the pro side. The anti-competitive motivation would be that the merger would allow the merging parties this newfound market power, and that market power could take the form of either selling power over shippers on overlapping or even on complementary routes, and hopefully we'll get into that, or over their buying power, newfound buying power over their suppliers, including labor. So I also just want to note, I don't know if you guys saw this in the news yesterday, but the largest labor union, I think it's called Smart TD Union, which represents conductors and other rail workers, you know, signed off on the merger yesterday. That doesn't mean it's not going to harm workers, but they extracted a promise from the CEO saying that he promised not to lay off any workers as a result of the merger.
Let's dive down. I'm going to take a break here in just a moment. I want to pull Lockie back into the conversation, because I think what we need to understand here in Montana, our primary provider, as Lockie had said, is Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. How does this merger of the UP and NS impact the way we do business with the railroad in Montana? And Lockie, when we come back, I'm gonna have you dive into that question for us. Give some context to how this impacts Montana when we come back to Voices of Montana. Well, welcome back. We are talking railroads. We're talking merger. We're talking the game of Monopoly. But we're also talking about business in Montana, agriculture, how we transport goods using railroad. And it's a very intriguing conversation we're having. It is wrought with a few politics and all kinds of things. On the air with us today are Hal Singer, who's the director of the Utah Project out of the University of Utah. He's our resident economist this morning today. And then also Lockie Edwards, who's a third generation wheat farmer, just farming outside of Big Sandy, Montana. Gentlemen, thank you again for joining us. We are specifically talking about the merger of the Union Pacific Railroad and the Norfolk Southern Railroads and what that means. And we were starting to peel that onion just a little bit on all the details of what that might look like and some of the regulatory process. We'll dive into more of the how those decisions are made in a moment. But Lockie, I wanted to pull you into the conversation. Hal set the stage for what this merger, how it might play out and some of the why behind it, although we don't know that by detail. But how would a merger of two main player railroads impact how we do business with our partner railroad in Montana?
Well, one thing history has, I think, proven, I don't think too many people would deny, that mergers are fraught with disruption. They don't just happen smoothly. So there will be disruption in the networks. And while that may not be on BNSF Railway in Montana, there will be some effects for that. But my primary concern for Montana agriculture is that if this, we can call it a merger, but it's a takeover by the UP of Norfolk Southern is really what, that's the reality. And they will increase, they've already proven themselves to be, to do what I call extractive railroading. In other words, cutting back on costs, investing less, and sending more to the stockholders. That's kind of apparent to me, at least, that there are activist stockholders pushing for this, for higher dividends and better return and maybe a quick buck. But
They are for-profit corporations. I mean, that's part of what they do. They have to meet expectations of share. That's part of who they are as an entity, and that's important. But they also have to serve a customer.
Exactly. I see it even on the farms in Montana. There are farms that invest in the future. They put money back into their operations, and instead of just kind of riding the horse till he's lathered up and too tired to go, and then doing something else. And my big concern for Montana is that BNSF may be forced to compete with the same tactics, because they are in competition with the Union Pacific, and I just think we're headed down the road toward what I call extractive railroading, and the Union Pacific has, well, all the railroads have moved that way. It started with Hunter Harrison of the Canadian Pacific. He kind of invented it, you might say. But other railroads have adopted that, and that is not good for service, and this market power. It's not just about rates. Service is extremely important for Montana agriculture. That makes markets, my biggest fear is that this will set the stage where everybody has to compete with that model.
So, Hal, I think I read an article, maybe you had written it or someone else had written it when I was studying for this a little bit, that suggested what Lockie just said, and that is, hey, let me remind you, Warren Buffett is a principal owner in Burlington Northern Santa Fe. There's clearly some means there to take that next step. How Is that just a rumor? Is that speculation? What is there going to be further consolidation? Hal, give us some insight on that.
Well, look, I mean, Lockheed's exactly right. And you see this extreme form of capitalism, in so many industries, nursing homes get taken over by private equity. And you see them making these decisions that now are how can they just extract? But the problem is that if you went in front of the regulator and you said, I want to block the merger because of that, they'd really want you to focus on what I'd consider to be merger specific harm. So if I could, I'd just like to take you through a few that I think are going to get teed up, right? So I want to kind of focus on this claim that shippers in Montana could face higher shipping costs. Now Lockheed's correct; there are other harms too, lower service. But economists like to fixate right or wrong on things that we can measure, like prices. And so I think that might be a real kind of bone of contention. I've looked at the routes, and if anyone of the two railroads, if anyone's interested, they can look. The New York Times put out and the Economist magazine, when they put out their kind of fluff pieces promoting the merger, had maps of the rails. Very interesting to study the maps. You'll see there's a significant amount of overlap in the rails in the middle of the country. And this is the Chicago to Kansas City and Chicago going through St. Louis. And the problem there, I mean, this is the easy story. I'm going to get to the harder story in a second. I just want to focus on the overlap routes. But if you start from a concentrated industry, say like a route is served by, say, three carriers today, and it goes from three to two, the basic economic models will predict massive price effects on those routes. You can even have routes that are going from two to one in the middle of the country. And, of course, that's a merger to monopoly. And so that would also be expected to produce really disastrous price effects. Now, that's the easy part. The harder part is, and something that the merger parties are going to focus on, is we have these complementary lines. These are the non-overlapping lines, right? And they're going to try to claim that no economic theory would predict price effects there, right? Now, it turns out, and this is kind of a fun discovery, that UP was weighed in on the Canadian Pacific Kansas City Southern merger about a decade ago, and they hired an economist named Steve Salop. And Steve's a friend of mine, he's a professor at Georgetown University. And Steve put forward a paper that showed that even on complementary routes, what are called typically vertical mergers, that economic theory can predict price effects. Now, this stuff is complicated, but Steve basically pointed out that under certain conditions, such as like when the market participants sell differentiated products or when the carriers set their rates based on imperfect information about each other's costs and rates, that a vertical merger can yield enhanced selling power to the merging parties. One other thing that is interesting, you can just pull it right off the STB's website. Steve pointed out that how a vertical merger could give a fresh incentive to the merging parties to raise the rates for interline movements of railroad rivals. So I raise this because it's going to be difficult now for UP to argue that there's no chance that on the complementary routes prices will go up. They've actually filed an expert report in the last proceeding 10 years ago.
Hold that thought just a second, Hal. I've got a break coming up because this, and I feel like I'm in your class and I'm getting this lesson on economics and mergers and their real consequences to these decisions that are made as economic decisions. There are broader consequences. We're going to talk about those broader consequences. And we're going to drill back down into how about the consumer in Montana? How are we going to be impacted when we come back to Voices of Montana?
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
And hello, everyone. This is Steve Armaskow. I'm substituting. I feel like a substitute teacher in class today, in an economics class. I am honored to guest host Voices of Montana this morning. We have this intriguing topic we're working through. It does feel a little bit like we're going to economics, our senior year of economics class, we're talking about railroad mergers. We have Hal Singer, who's the director of the Utah Project out of the University of Utah, and then Lockie Edwards, who is a part of the Ag Rail Business Council and a grain grower outside of Big Sandy, very involved in the rail industry. Lockie and Hal are great experts on this whole topic of railroad mergers and how it might impact us. We were diving into a little bit of the impacts of a merger. Hal, I want to back you up a little bit and just walk us through the steps in the decision-making process. There was a notice of intent filed by both railroads, I'm assuming. And so walk us through the steps in that process.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should tell you that we're in a little bit of a new place here in the sense that we have these new merger guidelines that the Surface Transportation Board put out. We also have new merger guidelines that the Federal Trade Commission and the DOJ put out in 2023. You know, there was a merger that occurred after the new guidelines came out, but it was grandfathered. It was that Canadian Pacific Kansas City Southern merger, but it was grandfathered for reasons and subjected to the more lenient standard of the older STB guidelines. So this might be one of the first applications of the newer guidelines.
Okay.
And the newer guidelines do have more teeth. You know, they were trying to basically tap the brakes, no pun intended, on all the consolidation that was happening, you know, prior to that moment. And so the question is, you know, what are the merging parties going to have to show here? And I think there's going to be three really tough questions. And the first one is this efficiency claim that they're making. They're claiming that you're going to have faster trains. I don't know if you saw the New York Times or the Economist story, but they appeared as if they literally cut and paste the PR release from the merging parties and said that, you know, if you allow us to merge, we're going to have, you know, faster service than what we used to did and that we used to achieve. My question for them, and I put this in my Sling piece, is why couldn't the same efficiencies be achieved via contract, such as track sharing arrangements?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens.
And if so, then these purported benefits that they're touting really are not merger specific, right? They don't depend on the merger per se. So I think that's going to be the first fight. The second fight is, and it's something that Lockie raised before about service disruptions, but how does this merger avoid the same widespread service disruptions that have plagued other mergers in the industry, including the Canadian Pacific Kansas City Southern merger that was completed in 2023? So right after that merger, the combined railroad experienced widespread service disruptions if they tried to merge their two legacy IT systems. You know, and the question is, how are you guys going to avoid that fate? And I guess the third issue that I think is going to be teed up, it's on the issue of price. I'm wondering if what guarantees the merging parties could make not to raise prices on shippers or on rival railroads for interline movements. Now, you know, would the parties be willing to commit, I'm just throwing this out here, for example,
right,
to not raise those prices for a given period of time, say 5 years after the merger? Of course, if they have no intention to raise prices and this merger is pro-competitive, then that guarantee ought to be easy for them to give away, right? So I think those would be the three bones of contention, three issues that will get litigated, you know, in front of the STB.
And they, as I have read a little bit, their formal application for this merger would be dropped in front of the Surface Transportation Board January 2026 or some time frame like that. Then that board deliberates, probably takes, I don't know this for a fact, probably takes public comment. There's certain periods of input. Maybe there's a hearing. I'm not sure how public their process is. And then a decision is made. Give us a sense of that decision timeline. When will a decision be made?
Oh, I think that's hard to predict here. And I think it depends on how much interference we get, you know, from the Trump administration. If Trump and the team want it to go down quickly, I think it's going to go fast. And all signs are pointing to that.
It's a big deal. I mean, it's, as I understand it, $85 billion deal on the table. Trump loves big business. I mean, we all like the economy to move forward. And so there probably is some momentum to make things like this happen. I'm just curious, Lockie, what's gonna happen to the users of the rail system, your colleagues and partners in agriculture and manufacturing, and the supply chain. But what's also going to happen to guys like me? I'm not out there producing a product, but I'm a consumer of a product. How's this going to impact me as a consumer?
Yeah, well, Steve, the consumers in Montana, you have to remember, are largely consuming goods that are bought shipped in from out of state, right? So this is a national issue, and the consumers in Montana will be affected the same way the rest of the country is, and that's up for debate and will be debated at the STB. But yep. I think if you subscribe to my contention that this is about market power, I think that you can count on some added costs due to the increased market power that merging would give with this so-called transcontinental railroad. And I don't think it's, it will be denied and glowing promises will be made at the STB, and they'll try to back it up with numbers. And the opponents will do the same. And so it's just going to be a fight, and if the merger happens, I think we can count on increased costs, because these railroads appear to me to be going to want to send any savings to the stockholders, and that's the model. Yeah.
So, Lockie, I'm curious, and we had a shared kind of rail system, at least in our part of Montana, where in the southern part, where we had Montana Rail Link. But we also had Burlington Northern Santa Fe as your primary provider. And there was needed cooperation. There was rail sharing, other things. And then they've, I don't want to say merge, frankly, because Burlington Northern Santa Fe bought Montana Rail Link. How has that experience changed things for our system in Montana?
Yeah, so really there was no change there, Steve. Burlington Northern was doing the pricing there and running their trains, to some extent. I mean, a lot of it was Montana Rail Link, but yeah. You have to remember that Montana Rail Link always was, or in modern history, was owned by Burlington Northern Santa Fe already. They were just leasing that to Dennis Washington. And so it wasn't an acquisition, really. It was just Dennis wanted to clean up some stuff for his retirement or something, I think, and they just cut short the lease, right?
No speculation on that backstory, yeah, well. Lockie, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So that was seamless. That was a seamless transition, by all appearances, anyway. I'm sure, there were some uncomfortable things, but they kept all the same workers, and they're doing
and
the same
actually
work.
Expanded their operation as an outcome of that as well.
Yep.
Most people don't know, I don't know this for certain, but the Surface Transportation Board, as I understand it, there are two Democrat members, two Republican members, and then there's a fifth seat that's vacant right now. I'm assuming the president appoints that. Who appoints that vacant seat? And I'm assuming that appointment will be done before a decision on something like this moves forward. Is that correct, Hal?
Yes, that is correct. We've seen, however, how Trump is behaving with respect to Democratic appointees. I think he fired the last Democratic appointee on the STB recently, and that person, by the way, voted against a prior railroad merger. Oh, and we see what's going on with regard to the FTC. I think a case just got decided by the Supreme Court that they think that Trump does, in fact, have the power to fire Democratic
appointees. Yeah, I saw that, too.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm observing is that if Trump, wants a certain outcome, and I'll give you a few examples if you'll allow me. He'll put enough pressure on the regulator to make it happen. So there was the most high-profile case this happened a few months ago, but it was a merger at the DOJ where the staff was trying to stop it. It was the Hewlett-Packard-Juniper Networks merger. And Pam Bondi and some deputies of hers basically intervened and called it off, and it caused quite a ruckus. There were firings at the DOJ, and one professor, Roger Alford, returned to Notre Dame Law School and has been quite vocal about the interference. And so there's other examples I could go through if you want, but you know, Wells Fargo seems like they were bullied out of dropping out of a global initiative to reduce carbons, and under threat that the administration was going to investigate them on antitrust grounds. And I mentioned Kimmel at the top, but that the context there's a merger going on between Nexstar and Tegna, and I think that one can interpret the silencing of Kimmel as their way to try to curry favor with the Trump administration to gain approval of that merger and allow them to blow past any kind of.
Now, Hal, I'm gonna yes. push back on the Jimmy Kimmel a little bit and say that was a business decision that ABC, Disney, and their affiliate networks, who they have to partner with to actually broadcast things, they made that decision. I don't think Trump made that decision. Anyway, that aside.
That's fine. We don't need to get into
it. No, we won't get into that.
It does occur in the context of a merger proceeding. I just want your listeners to be aware that Nexstar is trying to acquire another slug of TV stations, and they want the FCC's approval. But I'll leave it at that.
All right, good. We're going to get back on track. We'll get back on track. Pun intended. Sorry, everybody out there.
Steve, I would like to add a little to that Vina and the UP are not the only people that are going to go and talk to the president about this. And I do think the president is going to have much to say about the merger, but he will be visited by others.
And oh, yeah.
There will be some good cases made. For instance, the president is trying to onshore a bunch of business, in other words, bring them back and get
that's right
things important. Going in the United States. And a good case will be made against that merger to promote that. So that's just one area that this may not be done in the White House, you know, even though the initial press has said that he likes. The merger, he likes UP, they're a great company.
Yeah, on September, I think it was the 19th or so, I was watching the news, and Trump has his little, I shouldn't say little, I don't mean that in a disparaging way, he does his little Oval Office kind of press briefing, and just out of the blue, in the context, you know, kind of out of context with that, he just mentioned, oh, I was talking to a railroad executive, and this merger, and it's it, and I thought, where did that comment come from? And then here we are a week later, I'm talking to you guys about it. And at that point, we didn't even know we were going to do the show. But I thought, okay, there's something at play here. But I think you're right, Lockie. There's a lot more voices to be heard here. And that's what I want to talk to you about, Lockie. When we come back, we're only going to have a minute or two when we come back. I want to know, where do you think our congressional delegation is on this merger? When we come back, the Voices of Montana. Well, what a conversation we've had today. I didn't think I would need to learn so much about merging railroads. It's been informative. It's important for Montana. Rail transportation is key to industries in Montana. I want to thank Hal Singer with the Utah Project and then Lockie Edwards. Lockie, as we were wrapping up that last segment, I asked you a question. Where do you think our congressional delegation is on this proposed merger?
Well, I have not talked to the delegation. I have to be respectful of the leaders of the farmer organizations in Montana, so I try to work through them. And so that's what I'm doing, is initiating conversations with the organizations to try to tell them at least my views on the thing, and they can trust me or not. But
So if I'm a producer out there and I want to learn more about this topic, can they reach out to you, Lockie? Who should they get in contact with?
Yeah, I mean, look, that would be a good initial point of contact, and I'll give you my email if you want. But to answer your question, the delegation in Montana has a long history, and I see no deviation from it on ag issues. And this is an ag issue.
Yes, it is.
They tend to listen to the commodity and farm organizations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're waiting for that. This is kind of new, and it's going to take a little time.
Well, Hal, Lockie, thank you both for being on Voices of Montana. We have a great show tomorrow. Ed Buttrey, CEO of the Montana Hospital Association, will be here. We'll talk healthcare in Montana on Voices of Montana.
You've been listening to Voices of Montana. Comments and opinions heard are those of the host or callers, and not necessarily those of this station, sponsors, or Northern News Network. Join us Monday through Friday at 9:06 for Voices of Montana.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.